This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, today on Dreamland, you have a treat in store for you. We're going to have a guest that we have never had before on the show, whom I was introduced to and was recommended by a number of friends, other friends, Dinah Pasulka, Jeff Kripal, Joshua Cutchin, Alan Steinfeld, Anthony Peake, a lot of friends. And you'll see why in just a moment. I want to introduce you to a man who has created something that is, in a sense, a work of fiction, but it's not a work of fiction. It's something more than that. So say good morning or good afternoon, wherever you are, good evening, to Mike Fiorito. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hey, Whitley. Thank you so much for having me on.
Good afternoon, good morning. Good to see you. I'm looking forward to this.
Me too.
Well, wow. What a book. Let me just read a couple of the things people have said about it. Here's Dinah Pasulka. For all we know is a manifesto for all of those fascinated by the numinous realities posed by the UFO. Mike finds the UFO in experiences as diverse as Catholic Mass to the modern rituals of heavy metal music, and reveals a decentralized transcendence, a fun and extraordinary experience. Dinah Pasulka. And that is so deeply true. Now, this is a work of fiction because it has to be, in a sense, but it is also a journey of the soul. And that soul is your soul. And that's what we're going to talk about, your journey. When did it start, Mike? Because this is the work of somebody who's gone very far into the close encounter experience and very deep.
Well, it started, it's interesting because it's a funny thing. I wrote a book called Falling from Trees. It's a collection of short stories. This was 4 years ago or so. And these short stories were, and I have to say at that time, I wasn't on the inside of the ufology path. I had not yet connected on that path. I had connected in different ways. So I wrote this book, these short stories that are imagine sentience in the future, the evolution of human consciousness, a communication with non-human intelligence. This book set in motion, it's interesting, I read Jeff Kripal's book, The Flip. I wrote to Jeff and I said, you know, I feel like I read your book before I wrote my book, but that was not the case. I felt like his book informed my writing. That book set in motion, Jeff Kripal's book, and then I read your books as well, and a slew. I mean, if I showed you my library, it's kind of daunting. My wife won't let me bring any more books into the house.
But let me just stop you right here. Let's read what Jeff Kripal said in the book about your book. The UFO phenomenon is about many things, some of which can only be transmitted in the genre of fantastic literature itself, based on dreams, altered states, and out of body experiences. Mike Fiorito knows that and writes what he knows. Flying saucers appear alongside books, both of which appear alongside the so-called dead. We are them. Take that as large and vast as you can. What a statement.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the dead in your life as you understand that presence.
So a lot of my communication comes through dreams. I was reading the Afterlife Revolution while my mother was basically dying. And unlike you, you've had these elaborate communications. And I do want to touch on how there's something similar that happens to me, but it's not necessarily communicating with the dead. For me, Whitley, there was a revelation of the continuity of life and death. And when you're with someone who's in the transitioning stage and then is no more, and the revelation is they're released into, you know, they're released back into the earth, into their constituent parts. And now they're in your dreams. So I do have, I'm a very deep dreamer, and I keep a dream journal, and I do want to read some from some of my dreams. But there's this, for me, there's the revelation, and I think your writing kind of buttressed this this take of it is one continuous fabric of from here to there. And what Jeff was alluding to is penetrating that veil through different modalities. It could be through out-of-body experiences. It could be through a psychedelic experience, of which I've written a lot in the book as well. And it could be through
you've had that psychedelic experience. Yeah. I gathered that from the book, yeah.
Yeah, and I, you know, I didn't want to. It's not like I'm promoting it. It's a powerful way to get out of your ego. And yeah,
it's a tool, definitely, for that. And that's exactly, actually, what it does is it shuts down the ego.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that probably, for the most part, you start to see the real world. I can't do psychedelics, sadly enough. I got an unusual brain, but I have the same effects. I'm sort of a self... I have my own psychedelic machine inside my head.
You do.
So I know exactly what you're talking about. That's what I'm saying. But let's go on with you.
Yeah. No. You do. And I think what I wanted to approach in this book is I didn't want to do the usual story. I wanted to look at the commonplace. So the commonplace experience, when I say commonplace, the not the untypical. If we take the psychedelic experience, I mean, Terence McKenna wrote about that pretty extensively, and he believed it was a medium to communicate to non-human intelligence. And he had some of it is they're quite hysterical as well. But he used it, and he talked to shamans who believed that they could vomit up ayahuasca, spread it on the ground, and use it in a way as a scry, or to navigate space-time, to engineer space-time.
I had never heard that before. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. Yeah. So in, I think it's either in the archaic revolution or true hallucinations, but this shaman vomited up ayahuasca, and this is something was common. It wasn't a one-off thing. And then would spread that on rock. And then from that could, you know, navigate other places in the way that when you read about non-human intelligences that are able to do what a level 3 civilization can do to re-engineer space-time. And I see these things as a coalescence. So that could happen through dreams. That can happen through extraordinary experiences. People like you who have, your antenna is, you're beaming, they're beaming in to you. And I've heard you say at various occasions, you know, they're coming to you. You don't have to put anything out there.
No, fortunately, I'm a cheap guy and I don't have to spend the money. So. Anyway, but let's get back to this. What you're saying essentially is that there is a convergence here of paths. One is the path of writing of books for you, mm-hmm. and the other is the path of this journey into this other world. And you've woven a kind of a fiction out of it. Mm-hmm. Would that be accurate?
That is. That is, and I did want to keep it fiction because number one is publishers won't talk to you. If you are going to write a testimonial, they don't want to talk to you.
No.
Unless you self-publish.
That's why I publish myself.
Exactly. And I wanted to be read. Also, I think that some people will not pick up a book when it says UFO and it says testimonial. They just won't pick it up.
Most people won't pick it up.
Right. They won't pick it up. No. My intention was to invite other people into the conversation. I've done a lot of research and I've put a lot of thought in. I mean, I have a philosophy undergrad degree. I've taken, philosophy of mind, philosophy of science. Those things do factor into the writing. And then I went on to an English literature master's. But I wanted to, in a way, I don't want to say sneaky, I wanted to have a way to invite other people into the conversation, people who have taken psychedelics, people who have had out-of-body experiences, people who are intense dreamers, to invite them into this conversation, which to me is the most important philosophical conversation. Who are we? Why are we here on this planet?
And what is looking at us? Because something is looking at us. Listen, we're going to take our first break.
Yeah.
And so those of you on the free side, you'll see all of you will see an image of the book. I urge you to buy the book and read it because the book in a certain way is very transcendent. It's a healthy thing to do to read a book like this. Not to mention the fact that despite the fact that it's healthy, it's also loads of fun. Okay. We'll be right back. We're talking to Mike Fiorito. For All We Know is the name of his book. Mike, do you have a website?
I do. It's MikeFiorito.com. I could type it into the chat.
No, don't. Yeah, sure, if you wish to. But we will make sure it's featured. So you can go to what will we find at MikeFiorito.com. The reason, I mean, I already know, to be honest with you, and I think, but the truth is, if you tell our listeners, it's much more likely that they'll get engaged.
Sure. Well, so it's a website about, it talks about my books and, I'm mainly a music journalist and I do want to talk about that as well. So I've done a lot of music journalism and it also shows, some of the books I've done. I think I've done about 7 books. The last one before For All We Know was called Mescalito Riding His White Horse, which is a marriage of spirituality and bluegrass. Go figure that, huh?
Okay. I can't pass that up. A marriage of spirituality and bluegrass.
Yeah.
I go way back with the origins of this music.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Uncle Dave Macon fan, among other things. So I know where it came from.
Yes.
Let me know a little bit more about that.
Sure. Sure. I know you're from Texas. I believe you're from Texas.
Yes.
So I had a short interview was supposed to be with Peter Rowan, who is a bluegrass.
I know his work and love it.
Yeah. A great guy and super interesting. He's a self-proclaimed Buddhist, interested in wisdom traditions. And so Peter and I had actually a few conversations and I'm getting these dreams and I'm getting these things coming to me. And I said, Peter, I'm seeing a bigger project. Would you be interested? He said, well, tell me about it. I said, it's where bluegrass meets Buddhism. And the title is called Mescalito Riding His White Horse. He goes, tell me more. And Peter played with Bill Monroe. Peter is very knowledgeable. Bill Monroe is the father of bluegrass, and very much so.
I know. Yeah. Ann and I were very privileged to be around in Bill Monroe's time. We went to many of his concerts.
Yeah. So you know, and there's real magic. There's magic in all music. this music, and when you're speaking to someone who's, he's a source, Peter, and he knows it. He's a very down-to-earth, regular guy, but he is a source. And he kind of had these, you know, nuggets and these anecdotes, and they were lighting me on fire. And I'm having these dreams, and then we're having synchronicities occur. So I said, oh, Peter, I should send you my book, Falling from Trees. This way you'll kind of get a sense of my imaginative process. And he goes, you know, I wrote a poem called Falling from the Trees, which he then read to me. And so we were having, both of us, these synchronicities. And I think I wrote the book, I mean, maybe in 3 months, possessed completely.
That's and I often wondered. Synchronicity, you just let it sort of pass by, but my goodness.
Yeah.
You were in sync on another level. And that other level is a lot. It sort of is reflected in your book, in the book we're talking about. There's a connection that can't be put into words in nonfiction. I think that was what Jeff was referring to, but you captured it.
Hmm.
And you know, it's fascinating to read the novel. You get to the point where in some way inside you is a real thing happening. It's fascinating. That's why you're on the show. This is probably the first novel I've done in 10 years.
Hmm.
So,
wow. Thank
but
you.
This mostly, I mean, we're here for, we're looking for information. We want the facts here. Well, these are facts, all right, folks, but they're not the kind of facts you usually find in the world. You will find the facts when you read the novel, but you won't find them in the novel. You will find them in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That happened to me. Oh, just as an aside, did you ask me for a quote by any chance?
I think I did.
Well, I knew it. When I saw all those other names, I knew darn well you had. And you're talking to somebody who gets sometimes 200 emails in a day, which are actionable, and I just did not see it, and I'm so sorry.
That's desperately
need a personal assistant. But I also desperately need a bigger income if I'm going to afford such a thing. So there you have it. Okay.
You sell more books, right? I mean, that's the only way.
Yeah.
So one of the things you mentioned, if I could take on that, Whitley, is you mentioned one of the things I read in Diana Pasulka's book. I think it was her second book. It may have been American Cosmic. I don't remember which one, but how, and this is something I practiced, where you are the UFO. You are the vehicle of transition, of transportation.
Of transportation and transformation both. Yeah.
So in meditations, you know, lying down. It works especially well, I discovered later, with using binaural beats. So Robert Monroe, the Monroe Institute, and all those Monroes.
I knew him,
right?
Too.
I'm sure you did.
Oh, yeah.
And there are different methods to, and that's kind of the theme of the book is, like you said, a spiritual journey, but you have to go explore ways to tap into it, using a binaural beat, using music. I mean, that's a very central theme of the book, is music as a vehicle.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because I think you know a great deal about music and frequencies and things like that. I can tell from the way the book's connection and relationship to music, folks, is so fun. Please do enjoy it. Really, I'm very being very serious here, but tell us a little bit about the sort of inner meaning or inner power of music.
Sure. You know, I think there are a lot of levels. So I think at the very basic thing, the universe is noisy. I mean, from pulsars to grasshoppers rubbing their limbs together to the trees, of course, the birds. Humans have tried to mimic these sounds. We've tried to mimic them in music. And so just observing and being attuned and listening, first of all, just listening to the tremendous amount of sound that's in the universe, there's something meditative. I also think there are layers of culture. There are layers of meaning in music. So when I listen to music, jazz, I kind of drive my wife nuts because I'm a deep listener. And I believe that this, think of Close Encounters of, no, yeah, Close Encounters. Bum, 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 bum. That this is, there is an intelligence being communicated.
Yes.
That is inexplicable. I mean, there's the feelings we get. There's, of course, the emotions we get. Think of everything important that happens in life. There's a music accompaniment to it. Birthdays, graduations, death. There's a music modality of some kind. But I also think there's something there that when we hear it, we will be hearing something, a communication that is extraordinary. And I think it's buried in the matrix of the music. And you hear it in bluegrass. Well, you can hear it in any music, I think. You can hear it in disco.
The thing is, you can hear it in bluegrass very well. You know, folks, you know, music is a spiritual journey. Rock is a spiritual journey. All kinds of music, spiritual journeys are very profound. And I agree with you about not only about bluegrass, but about all kinds of music. And tell us more about that, the spiritual journey that's in bluegrass, though.
Well, I think with bluegrass, it's very fast. And that's the way Bill Monroe codified it. He wanted to be, you know, he said to Peter Rowan, follow the horse's hooves, you know, and it has that kind of rolling rhythmic quality to it. But if you're not paying attention, think of like Dixieland jazz in a similar way. When you listen to Dixieland jazz, you have to listen probably 100 times before you begin to hear it, a song or something, because it sounds like bike horns, you know. You're not hearing it clearly. With bluegrass, deep in the matrix of that fast-paced sound, if you peel them, you peel those pieces, you begin to hear things more clearly. And there's a spiritual journey. I mean, often the songs are spiritual too. You know,
I drove my wife crazy too because I have a tendency to listen to things time and time again.
Yes.
Did you ever come across a fiddler named Tex Logan?
Oh, sure. He played with Peter Rowan.
The Transcendent.
Yeah.
I have every piece of Tex Logan music I can find. There's actually some good. There's even on YouTube, there's a concert where he is doing Cotton Eye Joe.
Mm.
The title of the concert clip is Old and in the Way. And Ann and I were at the concert.
So you have to hear this. So the song you've just named, Old and in the Way, is a Peter Rowan song. So
see, that's how these things work. It's so fun. That's why I love doing the show.
And
we're weaving something together. It's so fun.
Yeah, we're stitching it. We have to participate in this, right? It doesn't just it may just land right in front of us, beaming and illuminating. But interestingly, so Peter's from Massachusetts. Tex, I know, is from Texas, and he was actually an engineer.
Unfortunately,
his
background is very weird, folks. Tex was a scientist and worked at Bell Labs,
uh-huh.
And then he put on his cowboy hat, get out his fiddle out. And be probably one of the greatest fiddlers in the history of bluegrass.
Yes, and he was instrumental. Apparently, the bluegrass trail, it didn't go through New York City. It somehow, Peter said, it kind of passed New York, went Pennsylvania around New York for some reason. We can talk about that, but it went into Massachusetts. And he met Tex when he was, because Tex was older than he was. And Tex kind of took him under his wing. I'm friends with his daughter, Judy Logan. And whenever I see, I have a Facebook page it's a Peter Rowan appreciation page. And whenever I see a picture or something, I post it and I tag Judy, and she's very sweet and loves the kind of recognition.
I wonder if she has any of his music.
Maybe.
You know, because it would be great if someone put together a Tex Logan album and streamed it somewhere, you know. I mean, that is some of the greatest music ever performed.
I do. I could ask her. Music is funny. It's people get very proprietary about music. So it's so even in writing the book, Mescalito Riding His White Horse, which by the way is a lyric from Peter Rowan, he let me use his lyrics, which is very uncommon.
Yeah, it is true. Very uncommon indeed.
In literature, I can quote poetry. I can quote source as long as I footnote it. But music is very proprietary, and it's a very, very tricky thing. So I don't know. I can ask Judy. I've never actually met her, but we're friends.
Ask her anyway.
Yeah.
And let me know the result. You've got my email address.
I will.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get back to your book. I mean, we've digressed here a little bit here because for some reason we've ended up talking about people I just adore. Tex Logan, Bill Monroe, Peter Rowan are all huge names in my constellation. But for those of you who are into other parts of areas of music, one thing you can be sure of, I'm there too. Even the most esoteric music there is. Now, I started out asking a question about frequencies, and we immediately got sidetracked. So let's do this. Let's take another break. And then we'll talk a little bit about frequencies and then get back to the story and philosophy of For All We Know. We'll be right back. We're back, folks. We're talking to Mike Fiorito, his book, For All We Know. We are also channeling Tex Logan and Bill Monroe, I hope, and hopefully others will come join the party. So I'm gonna try, probably fail, by the way, to get some Tex Logan music to play at the end of this show. But my guess is the copyright machinery, which is very thoroughgoing and very, very dumb, will prevent me from putting it on YouTube, even though I will get permission. Okay. Well, anyway, that'll happen probably. Let's talk about frequencies and their significance, because I know that you have you ever to get into this. How about we start with the experience of music while on hallucinogens, for example. Mm-hmm. Let's go. I know you know something about
that. Oh yeah,
I know you, more than just a little. So let's explore that.
Yeah, you know, I remember, you know, the first time having done it, say I'm about 17. And what you realize is the music has been created to take you on a journey. So some music, I mean, any music could, but some music especially. So say, for example, the Grateful Dead or the Allman Brothers. Music, you know.
Dad, keep going, man.
Yeah. I mean, the Duane Allman's slide frequencies, the way he's playing those, they're very emotive, but they become a vehicle to take you to journeys. And I have watched, you know, I was in my friend's bedroom and watching the entire, you know, talk about space-time being re-engineered. And on a journey into the heart, the essence of things. And it could be any kind of music, some music you don't want to listen to. And I talk about it in the book. I went to a heavy metal concert, and that was a little scary on mescaline.
I think that it might not be a good idea to do that. But I have to tell you, when I go into heavy metal, it's another world for me, but I'm so partial. I've never found a type of music. I know when you open yourself to the unbelievable negativity that is in some music, you find that you can reach a higher plane by accepting its truth. Now, mm-hmm. So we disagree a bit on that, but go ahead. Let's go.
Yeah. You know, and I do think that what Aldous Huxley said is we can use these things and they open doors. And then we should also explore other ways, other modalities, you know, whether that be meditation or, but certainly I would say the psychedelics break the doors down, and you've put a sledgehammer on that veil that separates us from what is right in front of us.
You know, it's something that has really, I've studied the biology of psychedelics mm-hmm. very extensively. read many books about this, and the precise way that psychedelics put the ego to sleep, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, where would you come out when I ask you the question, do you think that it's only on things like psychedelics that we actually see the real world? Is that the real world? And is it so strange? Because the truth is, this world of the ego, where we live, we're only used to it, but it's mm-hmm. very strange.
Yeah, I think it is another world. It is a real world, for sure. And you know, Huxley used the term the reducing valve. So in order for me to go about my day, you know, foraging in the forest or whatever, and gathering and doing whatever you have to do, that blue little hint of light over there, that's shimmering right there. If that becomes a foreground of my awareness, which it can be, you know, on a psychedelic plant, a sacred plant, if it becomes that in my everyday, it stops me from being able to go about the business of gathering food, of taking care of everyday things. So that reducing valve, I think, keeps us on track with the basics of living. Now, if you do deep meditations, if you use a sacred plant, if you use binaural beats, some people have dreaming. I mean, when you're on a psychedelic substance, you are essentially dreaming awake. There's a book, Alan Hobson, I think, wrote a book, Dreaming While Awake, something like that, and exploring the physiology of dreaming and how it relates to the physiology of psychedelics. When you're dreaming, is that real? I think it's real.
I wonder. I often think that's more real than this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when we meet others in our dreams, maybe we can't bring it back, and neither can they, but it changes the way we are. I've had in my life a lot of love, and I often fall in love with people I don't even know, especially when I go to a UFO conference and there'll be other experiences there, experiencers, close encounter witnesses. Fall in love with them. I fall mm-hmm. in love with a whole room full of them all the time. And I think to myself, do we know each other on another level? And this isn't a theme in your book, but I have to ask you now about, have you ever had any classic UFO experiences? Because I couldn't find that from the book. I couldn't discern it.
The only, not a classic one where I've seen, I've had a UFO encounter directly. The only one that I could talk about, and I'm not sure, is just after 9/11. I was in Union Square. I live in New York City. And this had to be 9/13. And if you remember, because I believe you've lived in New York City at different times. You've written.
Oh, yeah. I lived in New York City for most of my life, actually.
Yeah. And maybe 9/13, September 13th, I'm looking up at the sky. Everybody was looking up at the sky. We were all obsessed with looking at the skies. And I see what looks like a kind of carrier still. You know, I can't tell you. I don't know height. About where a helicopter might be, but silent, still. And it was kind of cloudy that night. Clouds are rolling, wispy clouds are rolling by. No one else was looking up. Only I saw it. Now, that could have very well been a military aircraft. I don't know. But what seems strange to me, thinking about it afterwards, why did no one else see it? Everyone was looking up all the time and kind of traumatized. We were all traumatized. So I don't know if that counts. I do know that, and I could read to you excerpts from my dream journal, that they penetrate the UFO concept and ideas, and beings come to me in dreams very intensely. In fact, the writing of a lot of my writing comes from dream inspiration.
Yeah, I could feel that in the book. I definitely could feel that in the book. Let's do it. Have you got some handy? Excellent.
Yeah. Here's my dream, my dream journal.
Do this after. No, don't hold it up again. After the show, text me, send me an image of that, and we'll put it in the show right here. Let me make a note of the time.
Sure.
Okay. So the folks will see that very nicely when we're talking about it. Okay.
And that became the basis for the cover of Mescalito, but I'll talk about that. So this was dreamt that the aliens were presenting me with examples of how they reveal themselves right in front of us. Letterings and expressions that we know contain hidden messages in clear day, but we don't see it. That's one. What do you think about that?
I think it's true. You know, I was just this is so strange in a way. There's a lot of synchronicity going on in this show, folks. And I was just writing in the book I'm working on now about the fourth mind, about the larger mind. I was just writing about how they can, the little gray people can be completely invisible. Therefore, they could be anywhere. Our whole experience of life is actually not what it seems. And I think that note reflects that.
Like you said, you know, our ego gets in the way of seeing with our minds, with our hearts.
I think it's best to say that the ego gets in the way of the deep surrender that is necessary to make the journey toward the truth, towards one's own truth.
Mm-hmm. And that could even be the title of a bluegrass song. Can I read one more?
Oh, you can read many more. We're here to enjoy you, Guy, and I certainly am doing that.
Well, thank you. I dreamt that I saw a space shuttle type spaceship ripping across the sky. Many of them, one at a time, separated by about a minute. This seemed strange, but then a string of, and by the way, these are written as I wrote them at like 2:30 in the morning. So they're not edited. But then a string of circular ringed white UFOs shot across the sky. In addition to UFOs, this is interesting, Whitley, because I think it's represented in the book too. And I'd like to talk about it for a minute. In addition to the UFOs, there were also gigantic pine trees, not standing tall, but lying sideways, connected to this long trail of UFO type ships. It seemed to my dreaming mind that the phenomena was reflecting the human mind back to us in this incredible display of power, that it was trying to represent itself to me in the way it thought I wanted to see it. And I'd like to mention that a theme of this book, first of all, for all we know, so I'm saying I have questions. I don't know. But one of the themes of the book is to connect the terrestrial with the extraterrestrial, as above, so below.
Right.
This continuity, we're looking out in the stars, but right here, you know, I left the house today. I think it was felt like the first spring day. Immediately, I heard birds. I could feel spring coming. There's such rich intelligence right there. And we're passing it by all the time. We're not even paying attention. We don't hear the birds. We're not listening.
Where, if I may ask, people are going to be curious about where you live.
I live in Brooklyn. I live in Brooklyn. Yeah, and oh gosh, what is it called?
Last I heard, it was still February. Am I wrong?
It is, but today was a warm day. It was maybe 55, and it was, you know, markedly different. You know, when you feel, it felt like the birds, they're kind of pulling spring. You know, they're pulling them, and they're the heavy lift and bringing it forward. But it's palpable that today was among the first times that I heard the birds signaling. And to my point that, and what we've been discussing, that the infinite is right here. And it's happening at this moment, and we're not seeing it. Maybe a psychedelic substance can take you there. Maybe a profound experience of some kind can take you there. Maybe binaural beats or vibrations, music can take you there. We are missing it all the time, or some of us always, and some of us sometimes.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of music videos on YouTube which are at a certain frequencies, different frequencies. That's what I was talking about. I'm very interested in that because I listen to that while I work, and it gets into you in deep ways. It's
interesting.
Fascinating.
Are they binaural beats or just frequencies? Are they random frequencies or very specific kinds?
Yeah, I have Bob Monroe's entire collection of.
Oh, okay.
I mean, not Bob Monroe.
We're doing the same thing.
Right, exactly. anyway, I have the entire collection of Robert Monroe's stuff.
Right.
I'm getting tangled up between Bill Monroe and Bill
Me too.
Monroe and Robert Monroe. Anyway, you know, Robert Monroe told me a very interesting thing. He said he thought that his journeys out of the body had happened because his house, the roof of his house, was a pyramid, pyramidal shape. And I found that very interesting. Okay, but let's go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I find it interesting, though, that in using these binaural beats, he was having these communications with a non-human intelligence. And I think it's in Journeys Out of the Body.
Yes.
And extensive. And they even have a sense of humor. But it's not unlike the communications that you've described and that other people describe. This was one way that this was one modality that was used to penetrate that. Interesting that they wanted to provide guidance. They wanted to provide insights. They wanted to help, and they were giving warnings of you're not taking care of the planet.
Yeah.
This seems to be a consistent thing across. And I know you have what you've said is that the phenomena is we in the military sees the phenomena as cryptic because it is cryptic, right? You say that its messages are cryptic.
Yes.
Intentionally. And therefore the military and people respond cryptically, and that's hard not to. It's hard to argue with that because we don't get linear easily in a consensus reality way bits to interpret of what the phenomena, how it comes into our lives. It seems to come in enigmatically.
Enigma is intended. And I think that it's as much our wish as it is the wish of the phenomenon itself to be enigmatic. Speaking of enigmas, folks, there's one enigma I just can't solve. And that is, why don't those of you who are not subscribers, which amount to listening to one of these shows between 70 and 100,000 people, why don't you subscribe? If 50 of you subscribed every week, I would be in seventh heaven. That said, goodbye, free dreamlanders. I'll see you next week. We're talking to Mike Fiorito. his book, For All We Know. I want to get a shift a little bit and get a little closer to the book. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell us a little bit about Mateo, who is the journeyer in the book or the main character. Just tell us a little bit about him. Get us, whet our appetites.
Sure. Well, Mateo is, he's, there's some biographical in there as well, for sure. Grew up in, on the streets of New York. So there's a lot of, he's very doubtful. He doesn't, if you grew up in the 70s in New York, you would be doubtful and distrustful of tricksters. I think, and that's an important aspect of the book.
Yeah. He's I lived through the 70s in New York with Anne when we were young married. So yeah. I know what you mean.
And I lived in the projects of Queens, which were pretty rough and tumble. So this kid, who's an unlikely person to Mateo, is to have the spiritual, the spiritual journey. And he's, you know, on the street, you have to be cautious. You don't trust people. For all we know, you don't know. And he has these various encounters. He's curious about spirituality. He goes to some, there used to be in the village a lot of, you'd have esoteric bookstores. I'm sure you remember.
I remember them very well.
Man, those were the
Wiser days.
Wiser.
Yeah.
There were so many of them, and I can't remember the name of them. I can't remember it right now, but I name it in the book. It's an actual one. But he's curious, but he goes and he doesn't, is this guy full of, can I curse on the show? Prefer not to.
I can't hear you. It dropped out. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. This guy, he encounters this, this mystic.
Yes.
And he doesn't know if the mystic is full of crap or what, but the mystic has still profound insights, and he's a Jungian, and kind of challenges Mateo. And this kind of pattern occurs over time, is he's a disbeliever. He's a skeptic. He wants to believe. He wants to explore. And so we follow this through different episodes of his life. From a young kid in the streets of New York City to then going to college in the village and encountering that world and, you know, the tricksters, and you know, they're out there. As much as there's what I've found in my journey in this work, there are many earnest people with stories to tell. There are a lot of tricksters too. And so Mateo,
both. You've got to be very careful.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true. And certainly the teachers that one of the teachers that Mateo encounters, he's a mystic in one of the bookstores. And, you know, there's the beaded curtain that you have to walk past to go into where he gives his lessons, his private lessons. And Mateo is thirsty for knowledge. He's thirsty for what is beyond that veil, you know, but there's a price to pay, isn't there? If you're going to get access, well, what are you going to give up? And so I wanted that to be, I didn't want him to be, Mateo, to be this starry-eyed kind of, you know, woodland fairy. I wanted him to be gritty. I wanted there to be a grittiness to this. I wanted it to reflect the difficulty of a journey. I wanted it to reflect, because I think most people are skeptics, and I wanted a skepticism, because I think there's what's the quote? There's more faith in honest doubt than in all of the creeds. Thomas Carlyle, who's a great Victorian philosopher. I wanted that. That's a theme throughout the book, and I mean, we never get to a place. Well, at the very end, we do get to, there is a grand illumination that occurs that includes the living and the non-living and consensus reality. There is an encounter, a profound, deep encounter that wraps it all together, but it still remains enigmatic. And I wanted the readers to go on this journey with me. I'm not offering final answers. In our little, with our little tiny human brains and our egos, no matter how much we work at penetrating and getting around the ego, we do remain in our paradigms. We can poke a little bit out. We can, like a turtle poking its head out. But I think we do remain trapped ultimately in this reality, in this incarnation of our existence. So I don't, was that an adequate description of Mateo? Did that resonate with you?
It resonates with me, and it's, let me put it this way, folks. It is a very heroic brush with this deep, complex character. So thank you. I don't think there's any way to put it into words except the words in the book itself. Yes. But you gave us, I think, a good taste of it. Let me read you a little bit from the book. This is called Church as a UFO. Because Long Island City High School, which is only, this is Mateo talking, only a few blocks away from our apartment building, has a reputation for dropouts and drug users. My parents insist that I go to Monsignor McClansky High School, an all-boys Catholic institution. Also, my parents are concerned about my pot smoking and what they consider to be wild behavior. I don't ever talk about it, admit it to anyone, even consciously know it, but I love being in McClansky's church. Even though I horse around with friends in the pews, I also look up at the vaulted ceilings and meditate on the stained glass windows. I especially love the Stations of the Cross. I now realize that the stations are very similar to the arc of Jung's individuation. Jesus is condemned to death, struggles with carrying the cross, is stripped, nailed to the cross, dies on the cross, laid to be buried in a tomb. And we all know that he will rise again. Beautiful words. And the image of that young guy in that church secretly loving it.
Yeah.
Working around with his friends made me feel like Mateo and Mike might be the same person.
Well, yeah, he's there's a lot of me in Mateo for sure.
Yeah,
and
I
would say that while ideologically I didn't connect with Christianity, but the images, I always connected strongly with the images.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm in the same place. I don't connect with it ideologically at all, but I do connect with Jesus. That's why I wrote that book, Jesus, A New Vision.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely do. Because Jesus had truth, and he, mm-hmm. he lived his truth. And we all want to find our own truth and live our own truth, which in a funny way, I find that gets me back to the issue of music,
mm-hmm.
and where music can take the heart, and psychedelics, and where they can. I mean, I know a hell of a lot about psychedelics because my psychedelics go off in me all the time. I mean, my brain's been thoroughly studied and it is a unique machine. So I don't want to go on about that, but in any case, there is a path somewhere between those two things. The psychedelic journey and the journey of music.
Mm-hmm.
And you're on that path. And Mateo is too, but you never, I'm not sure you actually understood it in that sense when you were writing the book, and maybe not even now. But tell us now what you see of your path and therefore also Mateo's path.
Yeah, I would say there's one, I have a story called Tom Turkey's Tie-Dye. And it's a kind of mocking a little bit of this friend of mine who had taken LSD when I knew him 300 times, you know, according to his own account. The first time I took LSD with him, I took 6 hits of blotter acid, which is an insane dosage. And there was this guy, I'm going somewhere with this. So this guy, Tom Turkey, who's this cool, you know, cool hippie, and he's got it all together. And in consuming this dosage, which was terrifying, I should tell you, by the way, it also punctured a hole in the space-time fabric of the world I lived in, and I knew. And it's become, I would say that is, that I've returned, that has been a fundamental, that experience was so transformational, so terrifying and wonderful, that it became the foundation after which my spiritual journey built upon. That was a principal beginning. I use the word sledgehammer to sort of smash the enclosure of my little Queens. And that, this is not just Queens. This is the projects of Queens. So it's, you know, lower socioeconomic kind of environment. People not college bound. People that don't have a lot of books in their houses. And I was always thirsty for this. I was always thirsty to read and to explore and learn. That became the basis. And accompanying that was music. And my journey is, you know, I'm a music journalist because I'm deeply interested in music. And when you talk to a musician, I'm also a musician as well. They can suffer fools. They don't suffer fools. You know, they know who's into the music and who's interested and who's done the homework. And so that parallel journey of, and I'm actually working on something now about the connection between music and the phenomena. And it's not, and it's broad. And you'll see that in the book as well. The phenomena isn't just a UFO encounter. That's just one spoke in the hub. There are many ways to have that illumination. That's one way. And so I've been, you know, meditating for not long after, by the way, that psychedelic experience, seeking out meditation centers, seeking out spiritual practice. And that's continues to today. You know, I'd like to, my ex-wife said, you know, she became a Buddhist after we broke up. And I said, you know, I was into Buddhism. Why weren't you? She said, you were a bad Buddhist. So I don't want to presume that I've gotten to a place of that I can sit here and pontificate. I'm on my journey.
I don't think Buddha would have been willing to pontificate either. So maybe it's a good journey you're on.
We know they're out there.
Yeah, exactly. The theme of morality suffuses the book. And you're obviously a very much of a moral person. And you you deny the ideology of Christianity. Well, what does your morality mean to you?
It's a great question.
They always say that when they weren't expecting a question.
Being an honest person, being true to yourself, these are very important things. I'm a father. I know you're also a father. I have two boys, and I think they taught me how to be a better person, and they helped me discover morality in me, the tenacity to do what I could for them, to be selfless. I discovered selfless through really fatherhood, which I was terrified to become a father. It wasn't, some people just can't wait. I was absolutely terrified. But then when my older son, and by the way, his name is Thelonious, named after Miles Davis. I'm just kidding.
I had a friend who knew Thelonious very well. And was with Thelonious when he when his last journey took place. And folks, you go for Thelonious Monk, please.
Yeah.
Don't hesitate. Go ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, my other son's name is Travis, named after Merle Travis. So the guitar player, and I use that right. style that's Travis picking. So morality, I'm not the best person in the world. we have a lot of evidence and witness testimony on that. But I think it's important. It's important to me to be true and to be honest to the extent that I can be, not to be honest and cruel, to be kind, to be thoughtful. These are real things. And, you know, if you, we can talk about the, this world here is an incarnation of these other worlds that are interfusing it. But Whitley, if I step on your toe, it hurts, you know, and kindness is important.
And yes.
So I strongly believe in those things.
It's kindness is also very energetic. And people who aren't kind are falling. People who are kind, really kind, are not falling. At least they're not falling. Mm-hmm. You know, and I do the Gurdjieff work, and in the Gurdjieff work, there is something called external considering, which is taking into your mind and heart the needs of others in the same way that you see your own.
Mm-hmm.
This is a fabulous practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I never will forget when I asked the saint behind me who's looking, watching over us right now, what compassion and, was.
Yeah.
She said simply, each of us is all we have. And that boy, I mean, you walk down the street and you see someone you judge and you dislike and you thought you're up in your high horse and I'm better, and you think, that person is all they have. And it completely changes everything. Suddenly, they feel very sacred.
Mm-hmm.
It's yep. terrifying to do that with people you know are evil. Murderers or people who you know for sure have done dreadful things.
Yeah. Compassion is... you know, the Buddha and that teaching is similar to some of the practices you do in Buddhism. And compassion is a highly creative act. You know, it's not looked at that way, but it takes tremendous creativity to imagine other people's lives and situations. And I love the, and gave you the phrase, have joy.
Yes.
Have joy in this life.
You right. know,
and I think that does in part come from, I guess you can get it in other ways. I get joy from giving and receiving love. And the more, you know, it sounds trite, but it's not about, it's the love you give. That's the important, because the receiving comes, but the love you give. And that's where joy comes in. And there's transcendence in that. There's, you're bigger than just you.
What do you think Mateo, the core of Mateo's journey is in the book? Because it's a spiritual journey and other kinds of journeys too. That's what makes it such a fun story. Mm. But there's a core here somewhere. There's a question he's pursuing that's not ever in words. And I think that's your question. And I wonder if you can articulate it. And if you can't, we all understand perfectly. I'm not sure. I wouldn't be very pissed off to be asked that on a recorded show like this. But I'm asking it anyway. See what you can do with it.
The journey is getting out of your own way, in part, and getting out of your container of paradigm. And to me, that is the journey that Mateo is going through.
It's and the journey of the book. I think you said it very well and better than I could ever say it. So you do know
I was lucky.
No, you know what you're doing. You knew you understood what you were doing when you wrote this. You know, so many topics are covered in it. Philosophy of mind, mm-hmm. cosmology, psychedelics, parapsychology. But Carl Jung is like a ghost in the machine. He's everywhere in the book. Tell us a little bit about your experience of Jung and what you have, the reading that you've done and so forth, because I know there must be a significant amount of it.
Yeah, I like the idea that Jung said, he always said, I'm not a metaphysician. He said, I don't want to talk about metaphysics. I'm a scientist, he said, for most of his life, until you read Memory, Dreams, and Reflections.
Yes.
And then he basically throws metaphysics, you know, he redoes metaphysics, says that we create the universe with our minds. And that metaphysical statement right there is deeply profound. Now that follows the theme of the book. So we create the universe with our minds.
We are a community, each of us individually a community, and collectively the whole species is a community made up of millions of little cells of groups of friends and larger groups and so forth, up all the way up to nation states and cultures and races and all of that, who are weavers, mm-hmm. weaving something. And in this book, Mateo is a weaver, mm-hmm. weaving his reality. I think it's a very beautiful thing and haunting in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the title kind of reflects that, because the title, For All We Know, is so haunting. How did you come up with that title?
It's also a song. It's Mary Carpenter, The Carpenters. So it's you know the song. I know you know it because you'll know the melody. Yeah. But you can use the title of a song in a book. You just can't use the lyrics.
Yeah, but I've been there and done that. Believe me, I've had, you know, the music world is hurting itself by being so guarded about its lyrics. It really is.
But and, you know, as a music journalist, I deal with that. And it's it could be frustrating because I'm promoting your work. So, you know, I'm giving attribution to your lyrics. That's a whole other thing. But, you know, also if I can show
the book will come up. Oh, plenty of, you don't need to hold it up.
Oh, what I wanted to emphasize was you see that the Mateo is standing there and you see the UFO image, which, by the way, I'm not the artist, but I gave the artist, I did probably 1,000 images like that using different digital tools.
Yeah.
And gave the artist, said, here's what I'm thinking. So they, you know, the artist, Pat Singer, who's done other book covers for me. So when I'm working on a book, I'll work with her and then we present it to the publisher. But you'll see that the UFO is creating that illumination. So it is, yeah. It is a spiritual path. For me, the UFO is a spiritual path.
Well, I think that's the essence of the story in a way. And it is a spiritual path. And the interesting thing is, I'm writing a book right now about its physical reality. And, I know a hell of a lot about the physical aspect of it. I always say to people who I have reason to believe are working on the materials, when you look at the materials, never forget that they're looking back at you. Because this is not what it seems. It isn't tourists from another planet.
Mm-hmm.
It is more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And those materials, I've got some of this stuff in my house, a little piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a consciousness and a life that's very, very different from the machineries of our world.
Mm-hmm.
You know that. And interestingly enough, I think it's probably because you've met the visitors psychedelically.
Through my dreams as well.
In your dreams, yeah.
And I think that they are physical as we go through this thing of we in the ufology conversation. Is it in your mind? Is it out there? It's both. And that's kind of what Jung, you know, it could very well be. I mean, we're looking at quantum mechanics and somehow we're wound up in it. Our consciousness becomes a part of the equation. We create reality. Isn't it funny that Jung was saying that we create, and shamans have said that. It's not, he's not the first person. He's, you know, among the first modern Westerners.
Bernardo Kastrup, who is the advocate of the idea of the world.
Right.
That the world, that this is an idea. And he's right in one sense. As Kastrup points out in his books, we cannot see the world. Mm-hmm. We can only perceive what our bodies, our impressions give to us. Mm-hmm. And this is why when you go on psychedelics or you end up with a peculiar brain, you often do see the world outside, from outside of your perceptual system. Mm-hmm. You see the other world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very different from this world.
Mm-hmm.
It is immeasurably rich, immeasurably complex, quite dangerous at times. Have you ever had a trip that felt dangerous?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
You know, the taking 6 hits of blotter acid is pretty much, and it's
especially
like
the first time I couldn't believe my ears when I heard totally. You say that. So what happened? We didn't really get into it before.
You feel possessed. You have been occupied. Something has taken over. And what you're seeing are aspects of yourself as well. And there's Terence McKenna talks about the elf machine, the little machine elves. And there's the kind of tricksters that are reflecting back to you your ridiculousness, your limitations, the smallness of your views. Interesting how these are all cohering around the same ideas. But it's terrifying because it's not just like a dragon that's breathing and you look and say, it is this thing that is you. You are that thing. And it is inextricably wound up with the very fabric of who you are. So it's terrifying. You can't escape. One experience I had, which was terrifying and profound, illuminating. So I'm with my friend, Paul, whose parents were born again Christians, and where the acid is coursing through our brains. It's pretty intense. And we look out the window and there's a tree outside his window. Both of us look at the tree at the same time. Now what happens next is unplanned. It just occurs. I'm looking at the tree and I see the leaves they're kind of moving like this, but then they start to get very mathematical in the way that music can be mathematical, this kind of algorithmic increasing of branches. And the branches are kind of, think of like fractals, this incredible speed at which patterns are producing. And we're watching this together, but then it starts to slow down. I'm not even aware it's happening. It starts to slow down where now the branches are moving kind of like snakes, very hypnotically. And what I'm experiencing is the inner life of the tree, the history of the tree. I'm communicating with this intelligence. And it is probably the most profound experience I've ever had, the most real experience. When we come out of this, it's funny, we kind of suck out of it, pop, both of us at the same time. We look at each other. We're comparing notes. Did you see what I saw? And we're comparing notes. That was pretty terrifying because, you know, it was as if I was inside the history and the experience of that tree, the thing in itself, the Ding Ein Sick. You know, I was seeing the essence of the tree.
You know, I think we've come to the end of our time together, but I think that to sum this up, there is a difference between intelligence and consciousness, and we don't recognize that difference. When you do a psychedelic trip, the intelligence begins to be replaced as the primary source of your being by your consciousness. And what you were seeing was the consciousness of the tree, and it was relating to you.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it wasn't saying, hey, hi, I'm a tree. It was relating to you. And like all consciousness, it is always ready to open itself to the whole history of being in this universe. And that, by the way, folks, is the truest meaning at the depth of the oracle. The temple at Delphi, on the wall of that temple, there was two words that we have actually been talking about without saying the whole time on this show. Know thyself. Mike Fiorito, for all we know, do go and get it, folks, and have fun with it. And we'll have Mike on. We're going to do the video interviews again, the Saturday morning ones. We're going to start that up again. Mike, I'm sure, will want to come and be with us.
Absolutely.
So, Mike, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a great conversation, and I've loved your books, and it was great to have this conversation. I can't tell you how much. So thank you. Thanks to everyone who listened.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.